forehand, he can hold in his memory the sound that results from solid contact. As a result, the body will tend to repeat the elements of behavior which produce that sound. This technique can be particularly useful in learning the different kinds of serves. There is a distinct difference in the sounds of a flat, slice, and twist serve. Similarly, one can learn to achieve the desired amount of spin in a second serve by listening closely to the sounds of balls hit with varying amounts of spin. Further, listening to the sound of the ball when volleying can improve both volley footwork and racket work. When a volley is met squarely at just the right moment, the action produces a wonderfully memorable sound. Some players find the sound of the ball more mind-absorbing than watching the seams, because it is something they've never done before. Actually, there is no reason why both means of concentration cannot be employed on each shot, since one need listen only at the instant of contact. I have found that the practice of listening to the ball is best used during practice. If you become sensitive to sound in practice, you will find that you will then use sound automatically during a match to encourage the repetition of solid shots. The habit will increase the number of balls hit solidly. Feeling. When I was 12 years old, I heard my pro say of my doubles partner, "He really knows where his racket head is." I didn't know what he meant, but I intuited its importance and never forgot the remark. Few players understand the importance of concentrating attention on the feel of the racket as they are holding it. There are two things that a player must know on every shot: where the ball is and where his racket is. If he loses contact with either of these, he is in trouble. Most players have learned to put visual attention on the ball, but many have only the vaguest notion about where their racket head is most of the time. The critical time to know the position of the racket is when it is behind you, and this requires concentration through the sense of feel. On the forehand, your hand is over a foot from the center of your racket. This means that even a tiny change in the angle of your wrist can produce a significant difference in the position of the center of the racket. Similarly, the slightest change in the angle of the face of the racket can have a substantial effect on the trajectory of the ball. In fact, if the face is off by only a quarter of an inch, the ball could travel over 6 feet out when hitting baseline to baseline. Hence, to achieve consistency and accuracy, you must become extraordinarily sensitive to feel. It would be useful for all tennis players to undergo some sensitivity training with their bodies. The easiest way to get such training is simply to focus your attention on your body during practice. Ideally, someone should throw balls to you or hit them so that they bounce in approximately the same spot each time. Then, paying relatively little attention to the ball, you can experience what it feels like to hit balls the way you hit them. You should spend some time merely feeling the exact path of your racket on your backswing. The greatest attention should be placed on the feel of your arm and hand at the moment just before they swing forward to meet the ball. Also become sensitive to how the handle feels in your hand. How hard are you squeezing your grip? There are many ways to increase one's awareness of muscle feel. One is to take each of your strokes in slow motion. Each can be performed as an exercise, in which all attention is placed on the feel of the moving parts of the body. Get to know the feel of every inch of your stroke, every muscle in your body. Then, when you increase your stroke speed to normal and begin hitting, you may be particularly aware of certain muscles. For instance, when I hit my best backhands, I am aware that my shoulder muscle, rather than my forearm, is pulling my arm through. By remembering the feel of that muscle before hitting a backhand, I attain the full benefit of the power it generates. Similarly, on my forehand, I am particularly aware of my triceps when my racket is below the ball. By becoming sensitive to the feel of that muscle, I decrease my tendency to take my racket back too high. It is also valuable to become more aware of rhythm. You can greatly improve your power and timing merely by paying attention during practice to the rhythm with which you hit each of your strokes. Every player has a rhythm natural to himself. If you learn to concentrate on the sense of rhythm, it is not difficult to fall into the rhythm most natural and effective for you. Rhythm can never be achieved by being overly purposeful about it. You have to let it happen. But sensitivity to rhythm developed through concentration helps. Those who have practiced concentrating on the feel of the path of their racket usually find that without intentional effort, their stroke begins to slow down and to simplify. Both the rapid jerks and the fancy stuff tend to disappear, and consistency and power tend to increase. Just as it is helpful to become more aware of the sound of the ball, it is also useful to practice focusing on the feel of the ball at impact. You can notice subtle and not so subtle differences in the vibration sent up your hand when the ball strikes the racket, depending on where contact is made, your distribution of weight, and the angle of the face of your racket. Again, you can program the best results by remembering as precisely as possible the feel in your hand, wrist, and arm after a good solid hit. Practicing this kind of feel develops what is called touch, and is particularly beneficial in hitting drop shots and lobs. In short, become aware of your body. Know what it feels like to move your body into position, as well as how it feels to swing your racket. Remember, it is almost impossible to feel or see anything well if you are thinking about how you should be moving. Forget shoulds and experience is. In tennis, there are only one or two elements to be aware of visually, but there are many things to feel. Expanding sensory knowledge of your body will greatly speed the process of developing skill. In the last few pages, I have discussed ways of sharpening three of the five senses and expanding the awareness which is received through them. Practice them not as a list of tennis do's and don'ts, but one at a time, and at your own rhythm. As far as I know, taste and smell are not crucial to successful tennis. You can practice these, if you like, during your meal, after your tennis match. The theory of concentration. The practices mentioned above can speed learning to play your best tennis. But we have come to an important point that should not be passed over quickly. Though focus of attention helps your tennis, it is equally true that playing tennis can help your focus of attention. Learning focus of attention is a master skill that has unlimited application. For those interested, let me elaborate briefly on some theoretical aspects of concentration. Whatever we experience on a tennis court is known to us by virtue of awareness, that is, by the consciousness within us. It is consciousness which makes possible awareness of the sights, sounds, feelings, and thoughts which compose what we call experience. It is self-evident that one cannot experience anything outside of consciousness. Consciousness is that which makes all things and events knowable. Without consciousness, eyes could not see, ears could not hear, and mind could not think. Consciousness is like a pure light energy whose power is to make events knowable, just as an electric light makes objects visible. Consciousness could be called the light of lights because it is by its light that all other lights become visible. In the human body, the light energy of consciousness does its knowing through several limited facilities, namely the five senses and the mind. Through eyes, it knows sights. Through ears, sounds. And through mind, it knows concepts, facts, and ideas. All that ever happens to us, all that we ever do, is known to us through the light energy of what is called consciousness. Right now, your consciousness is aware through your eyes and mind of the words in this sentence. But other things are also happening within the range of your attention. If you stop to listen closely to whatever your ears can hear, you will no doubt be able to hear sounds which you previously weren't aware of, even though they were going on while you were reading. If you now listen to these sounds closely, you will hear them better. That is, you will be able to know them better. Probably you were not aware of how your tongue feels in your mouth. But in all likelihood, after reading the foregoing words, you now are. While you were reading or listening to the sights and sounds around you, you were not aware of the feeling of your tongue, but with the slightest suggestion, the mind directs the focus of attention from one thing to another. When attention is allowed to focus, it comes to know that place. Attention is focused consciousness, and consciousness is that power of knowing. Consider this analogy. If consciousness were like an electric light shining in a dark forest, by virtue of this light, it would be possible to see and know the forest within a certain radius. The closer an object is to the light, the more it will be illuminated, and the greater the detail that will be visible. Objects farther away are seen more vaguely. But if we put a reflector around this light, making it into a searchlight, then all the light would shine in one direction. Now objects that are in the path of the light will be seen with greater clarity, and many objects which were previously lost in darkness will become knowable. This is the power of focus of attention. If, however, the lens of the searchlight was dirty, or there were bubbles in the glass that diffracted the light, or if the light was oscillating, then the beam would be dispersed, and some focus would be lost, and with it, clarity. Distraction is then like dirt on the lens of the light, or like the light jerking around so quickly that illumination is effectively reduced. The light of consciousness can be focused either externally, to objects available to the senses, or internally, to thoughts or feelings. And attention can be focused in a broad or narrow beam. Broad focus would be an attempt to see as much of the forest at one time as possible. Narrow focus would be directing attention to something very specific, like the veins on a particular leaf, on a particular twig of a branch. The here and now of the tennis court. Back to the tennis court. Watching the seams of the ball is a narrow focus of attention, and can be effective in blocking out nervousness and other possible irrelevant objects of attention. Sensing the feel of your body is a broader focus, and takes in a number of sensations that might aid in the learning of tennis. To take in the wind, the movement of your opponent, the trajectory of the ball, and the sensations in your body is an even broader focus, but perhaps quite relevant to the task at hand. It is still focus, because it leaves out all that is irrelevant and illuminates all that is relevant. One thing that can be said about focus is that it is always here and now, that is, in present time and present space. The first part of this chapter suggested several heres as objects of concentration. The seams focus awareness more exactly in space than merely the ball itself does, and as you add awareness of one element of the game of tennis after another, from the sound of the ball to the feel of each part of each stroke, greater knowledge is gained. But it is also necessary to learn to focus awareness in the now. This simply means tuning into what is happening in the present. The greatest lapses in concentration come when we allow our minds to project what is about to happen or to dwell on what has already happened. How easily the mind absorbs itself in the world of what-ifs. What if I lose this point, it thinks. Then I'll be behind 5-3 on his serve. If I don't break his serve, then I'll have lost the first set and probably the match. I wonder what Martha will say when she hears I lost to George. At this point, it is not uncommon for the mind to lapse into a little fantasy about Martha's reaction to hearing the news that you have lost to George. Meanwhile, back in the now, the score is still 3-4, 30-40, and you are barely aware that you are on the court. The conscious energy you need to perform at your peak in the now has been leaking into an imagined future. Similarly, the mind often draws one's attention into the past. If the linesman hadn't called that last serve out, the score would be deuce and I wouldn't be in this mess. The same thing happened to me last week and it cost me the match. It made me lose my confidence, and now the same thing is happening again. I wonder why. One nice aspect of tennis is that before long, you or your opponent is going to hit a ball, and this will summon you back to the present. But usually, part of our energy is left in the thought world of past or future, so that the present is not seen in the light of one's full awareness. As a result, objects look dim, the ball seems to come faster, appears smaller, and even the court seems to shrink. Since the mind seems to have a will of its own, how can one learn to keep it in the present? By practice. There is no other way. Every time your mind starts to leak away, simply bring it gently back. I used to use a ball machine with a wide range and velocity, and had a simple drill which helped players experience what it means to be more in the present. I asked students to stand at net in the volley position, and then set the machine to shoot balls at 3/4 speed. From being initially casual, they suddenly became more alert. At first the balls seemed too fast for them, but soon their responses quickened. Gradually, I turned the machine to faster and faster speeds, and the volleyers became more focused. When they were responding quickly enough to hit the top speed balls and believed they were at the peak of their concentration, I moved the machine to mid-court, 15 feet closer than before. At this point, students would often lose some concentration as a degree of fear intruded. Their forearms would tense slightly, making their movements less quick and accurate. Relax your forearm. Relax your mind. Simply relax into the present, focus on the seams of the ball, and let it happen. Soon they were again able to meet the ball in front of them with the center of their rackets. There was no smile of self-satisfaction, merely total absorption in each moment. Afterward, some players said that the ball seemed to slow down. Others remarked how weird it was to hit balls when you didn't have time to think about it. All who enter even a little into that state of being present will experience a calmness and a degree of ecstasy which they will want to repeat. The practical consequences to your volley of increasing your alertness are obvious. Most volleys are missed either because contact is made too far behind the player or because they are off-center. Becoming more aware of the present makes it easier to know where the ball is at all times and to react soon enough to meet it at the instant of your choice. Some people think that they are just too slow to return a hard shot when they are at net. But time is a relative thing, and it really is possible to slow it down. Consider, there are 1,000 milliseconds in every second. That's a lot of milliseconds. Alertness is a measure of how many nows you are alert to in a given period. The result is simple. You become more aware of what is going on as you learn to keep your attention in the now. After practicing being present to the moment, I found that I could change my position on the return of serve from standing at the baseline to standing only a foot behind the service line. If I stayed focused and relaxed, I could see even fast serves well enough to slow them down in time, respond, and pick up the ball just a split second after it bounced. There was no time for a backswing and no time to think about what I was doing or even where I would hit the ball. There would just be a calm focus and a spontaneous response to meet the ball and follow through, giving depth and direction to the ball. At the next instant, I would be at the net, well before the server. The server, seeing me standing at the service line to receive his serve, would have to deal mentally with what he might take to be an insult to his serve. He would often double fault more than once in an effort to teach me a lesson. His next problem would be hitting a volley passing shot from somewhere within no man's land. The reader might quite naturally think that this tactic would be impossible against a really first-rate serve. Not true. After only a few months of experimenting with this return of serve, I found it possible to use it to great advantage in tournament play. The more I used it, the quicker and more accurate my reactions became. Concentration seemed to slow time down, giving me the necessary awareness to see and place the ball. The fact that I met the ball on the rise cut off all the angle that a server usually gets on his serve after it bounces. And the fact that I could reach the net before the server gave me control of the commanding position on the court. Focus during a match. Most of the ways for developing concentration mentioned earlier are best employed during practice. In a match, it is usually best to pick one focus, whatever works best for you, and stick with it. For example, if the seams of the ball tend to keep you centered in the here and now, there is no need to focus on sound or feel. Often the fact that you are playing a match will help you to focus. During the course of a point, you often find yourself in a state of relatively deep concentration, in which you are only aware of what is happening at that instant. The critical time is between points. After the last shot of a rally, the mind leaves its focus on the ball and is free to wander. It is at this moment that thoughts about the score, your erratic backhand, business, the children, dinner, and so forth, tend to siphon your energy away from the here and now. Then it is difficult to regain the same level of concentration before the next point begins. How to stay concentrated in the here and now between points? My own device, and one that has been effective for many of my students, is to focus attention on breathing. Some object or activity which is always present is needed. What is more here and now than one's breathing? Putting attention on breathing simply means observing my breath going in, going out, going in, going out in its natural rhythm. It does not mean intentionally controlling my breath. Breathing is a remarkable phenomenon. Whether we intend to or not, we breathe. Awake or asleep, it is always happening. Even if we try to stop, Some force will soon overpower our efforts, and we will take a breath. Thus, when we focus on breathing, we are putting our attention on something closely connected to the life energy of the body. Also, breathing is a very basic rhythm. It is said that in breathing, man recapitulates the rhythm of the universe. When the mind is fastened to the rhythm of breathing, it tends to become absorbed and calm. Whether on or off the court, I know of no better way to begin to deal with anxiety than to place the mind on one's breathing process. Anxiety is fear about what may happen in the future, and it occurs only when the mind is imagining what the future may bring. But when your attention is on the here and now, the actions which need to be done in the present have their best chance of being successfully accomplished, and as a result, the future will become the best possible present. So after a point has ended, and I'm returning to position or going to pick up a ball, I place my mind on my breathing. The second my mind starts wondering about whether I'm going to win or lose the match, I bring it gently back to my breath and relax in its natural and basic motion. In this way, by the time the next point is ready to start, I am able to be even more concentrated than I was in the midst of the previous one. This technique is not only useful for me in stopping the mind from fretting about bad shots, but keeps me from being self-conscious about unusually good shots. Playing in Self-2 Zone. In the first chapter of this book, I referred to the ways people tend to describe their state of mind when they are playing their best tennis. They used to use such phrases as, playing out of my mind, or playing over his head. The current phrase is, playing in the zone. The interesting fact about this state of mind is that it really cannot be described accurately, because at the moment you are in that state, the one that usually describes is not present. After you are out of the state, you may try to remember what it was like, but it is hard. All you may know is that it felt good and it worked like magic. However, even though you don't know much about what is happening in that state, you can know a lot about what is not happening. You can remember that you weren't criticizing yourself. You weren't congratulating yourself either. You weren't thinking about how to do the stroke correctly or how not to do the stroke. You were not thinking about past shots or about the future score, about what people would think or even about the results to be obtained. In other words, what was missing was self-one. What was left was self-two. Because self-one is not in the picture, sometimes we say, I didn't do it, it just happened. Commonly students use language like, I wasn't there. Something else took over. My racket did this or did that, as if it had a will of its own. But the racket wasn't missing, and the great shot was not an accident, even though you didn't plan it. It was self-two hitting the ball. It was in fact you hitting the ball without the normal interference from self-one. Interestingly, this state of being, when self-one is absent and self-two is present, always feels good, and allows a more vivid consciousness and usually great excellence in performance. It may not feel the same as ego gratification, a feeling which we all too often like a great deal. But there is a feeling some call harmony, balance, poise, even peace or contentment. And it can feel that way in the middle of a very intense tennis match. Phil Jackson, coach of Michael Jordan and the four-time NBA champions, the Chicago Bulls, describes the state of self-two focus very well in his book, Sacred Hoops. Basketball is a complex dance that requires shifting from one objective to another at lightning speed. To excel, you need to act with a clear mind and be totally focused on what everyone on the floor is doing. The secret is not thinking. That doesn't mean being stupid. It means quieting the endless jabbering of thoughts so that your body can do instinctively what it's been trained to do without the mind getting in the way. All of us have flashes of oneness. When we're completely immersed in the moment, inseparable from what we're doing. I was reading a description of the zone by Bill Russell, the famous basketball player for the Boston Celtics. At that special level, all sorts of odd things happened. It was almost as if we were playing in slow motion. During those spells, I could almost sense how the next play would develop and where the next shot would be taken. Even before the other team brought the ball in bounds, I could feel it so keenly that I'd want to shout to my teammates, "It's coming there!" Except that I knew everything would change if I did. My premonitions would be consistently correct, and I always felt that I not only knew all the Celtics by heart, but also all the opposing players, and that they all knew me. It seems less odd to me now. It seems more like, yes, that's the way it is. That's the way it should be all the time. We can be focused. We can be conscious. One caution about the zone. It cannot be controlled by self one. I have seen many articles that claim to provide a technique for playing in the zone every time. Forget it. This is a setup. It's an age-old trap. Self one likes the idea of playing in the zone, especially the results that usually occur. So self one will try to grasp onto almost anything that promises to take you to what everyone agrees is a wonderful place. But there is one catch. The only way to get there is to leave self one behind. So as long as you let self one be the one that takes you there, it will be there too, and you will not be able to go into the zone. If you do, even for a moment, self one will say, "Good, I got there," and you will be out again. Another way to look at the zone is that it comes as a gift. It is not a gift you can demand of yourself, but one you can ask for. How do you ask? By making your effort? What is your effort? Your effort depends on your understanding, but I would say it always involves an effort to focus and an effort to let go of self-one control. As trust increases, self-one quiets. Self-two becomes more conscious and more present. Enjoyment increases, and the gifts are being given. If you are willing to give credit where credit is due and not think you know how to do it, the gifts are apt to be more frequent and sustainable. This may not sound scientific or may not sound as in control as you might like, but I can say that I've been courting self-two for a long time now, over 25 years consciously, and it comes at its own timing, when I am ready for it. Humble, respectful, not expecting it, somehow placing myself lower than it, not above it. Then, when the moment is right, it comes, and I can enjoy the absence of self-one thought and the presence of joy. I like it a lot. Grab for it, and it will squirt away like a slippery bar of soap. Take it for granted, and you will be distracted and lose it. I used to think that whatever was present in that state would leave me was ephemeral. Now I know that it is always there, and it is only I who leave. When I look at a young child, I realize it is there all the time. As the child grows, there is more to distract the mind, and it is harder to recognize. But it, self too, may be the only thing which has been there and will be there your entire life. Thoughts and thinking come and go, but the child self, the true self, is there and will be there as long as our breath is. To enjoy it, to appreciate it, is the gift of focus. Lapses in focus. It is perplexing to wonder why we ever leave the here and now. Here and now are the only place and time when one ever enjoys himself or accomplishes anything. Most of our suffering takes place when we allow our minds to imagine the future or mull over the past. Nonetheless, few people are ever satisfied with what is before them at the moment. Our desire that things be different from what they are pulls our minds into an unreal world, and consequently, we are less able to appreciate what the present has to offer. Our minds leave the reality of the present only when we prefer the unreality of the past or future. To begin to understand my own lapses of concentration, I had to know what I was really desiring, and it soon became clear to me that there were more desires operating in me on the court than simply to play tennis. In other words, tennis was not the only game I was playing on the court. Part of the process of attaining a concentrated state of mind is to know and resolve these conflicting desires. The following chapter attempts to shed light on this process. Chapter 8. Games People Play on the Court. That something else besides tennis is being played on the court is obvious to the most casual observer, regardless of whether he is watching the game at a country club, a public park, or a private court. He will see players suffering everything from minor frustration to major exasperation. He will see the stomping of feet, shaking of fists, war dances, rituals, pleas, oaths and prayers. Rackets are thrown against fences in anger, into the air for joy, or pounded against the concrete in disgust. Balls that are in will be called out, and vice versa. Linesmen are threatened, ball boys scolded, and the integrity of friends questioned. On the faces of players, you may observe in quick succession shame, pride, ecstasy, and despair. Smug complacency gives way to high anxiety, cockiness to hangdog disappointment. Anger and aggression of varying intensity are expressed both openly and in disguised forms. If an observer was watching the game for the first time, it would be hard for him to believe that all this drama could be contained on a mere tennis court, between love all and game, set, and match. There is no end to the variety of attitudes toward the game. Not only can the full spectrum of emotional response be observed on the court, but also a wide range in the motivations of its players. Some care only about winning. Some are amazingly tenacious about warding off defeat, but can't win a match point if it's offered to them. Many don't care how they play, just as long as they look good, and some simply don't care at all. Some cheat their opponents. Others cheat themselves. Some are always bragging about how good they are. Others constantly tell you how poorly they are playing. There are even a small handful who are out on the court simply for fun and exercise. In his widely read book, Games People Play, Eric Byrne described the subliminal games that lie beneath the surface of human interaction. He made it remarkably clear that what appears to be happening between people is only a small part of the story. The same seems to be true on the tennis court, and since, to play any game well, one must know as much as possible about it, I include here a brief guide to the games people play on the tennis court, followed by a brief account of my own search for a game worth playing. I suggest that this guide be read not as an exercise in self-analysis, but as a key to discovering how to have more fun while playing tennis. It's difficult to have fun or to achieve concentration when your ego is engaged in what it thinks is a life and death struggle. Self, too, will never be allowed to express spontaneity and excellence when self, one, is playing some heavy ulterior game involving its self-image. Yet as one recognizes the games of self, one, a degree of freedom can be achieved. When it is, you can discriminate objectively and discover for yourself the game you think is really worth playing. A brief explanation of the meaning of game. Every game involves at least one player, a goal, some obstacle between the player and his goal, a field, physical or mental, on which the game is played, and a motive for playing. In the guide below, I have named three categories of games with their aims and motives for playing. I call these games Good-O, Friends-O, and Health-O-Fun-O, and they are played both on and off the courts. Under each of these major categories are sub-games, which have sub-aims and sub-motivations, and even each sub-game has numerous variations. Moreover, most people play hybrid forms of two or three games at a time. Main Game 1, Good-O. General Aim, to achieve excellence. General Motive, to prove oneself good. Sub-game A, Perfect-O. Thesis, how good can I get? In Perfect-O, good is measured against a standard of performance. In golf, it is measured against par. In tennis, against self-conceived expectations or those of parents, coach, or friends. Aim, perfection, to reach the highest standard possible. Motive, the desire to prove oneself. Obstacles, external, the never-closing gap between one's idea of perfection and one's apparent abilities. Internal, self-criticism for not being as close to perfection as one would like, leading to discouragement. Compulsively trying too hard, and the self-doubt that made you think you had anything to prove in the first place. Subgame B, Compete-O. Thesis, I'm better than you. Here, good is measured against the performance of other players, rather than against a set standard. Maxim, it's not how well I play, but whether I win or lose that counts. Aim, to be the best, to win, to defeat all comers. Motive, desire to be at the top of the heap, stems from need for admiration and control. Obstacles, external, there is always someone around who can beat you, the rising ability of the young. Internal, the mind's preoccupation with comparing oneself with others, thus preventing spontaneous action. Thoughts of inferiority, alternating with superiority, depending on the competition. Fear of defeat. Subgame C, Image O. Thesis. Look at me! Good is measured by appearance. Neither winning nor true competence is as important as style. Aim. To look good, flashy, strong, brilliant, smooth, graceful. Motive. Desire for attention, praise. Obstacles. External. One can never look good enough. What looks good to one person does not look so good to another. Internal. Confusion about who one really is. Fear of not pleasing everyone and of imagined loneliness. Main game 2. Friendzo. General aim, to make or keep friends. General motive, desire for friendship. Subgame A, status O. Thesis, we play at the country club. It's not so important how good you are as where you play and who plays with you. Aim, to maintain or improve social status. Motive, desire for the friendship of the prominent. Obstacles, external. The cost of keeping up with the Joneses. Internal. Fear of losing one's social position. Subgame B. Togetherness O. Thesis. All my good friends play tennis. You play to be with your friends. To play too well would be a mistake. Aim. To meet or keep friends. Motive. Desire for acceptance and friendship. Obstacles. External, finding the time, the place, and the friends. Internal, fear of ostracism. Subgame C, husband O or wife O. Thesis, my husband or wife is always playing, so. Aim, to see your spouse. Motive, loneliness. Obstacles, external, becoming good enough for spouse to play with you. Internal. Doubts that loneliness can be overcome on the tennis court. See also internal obstacles of Perfecto. Main game 3. Healtho, Funno. General aim. Mental or physical health or pleasure. General motive. Health and or fun. Subgame A. Healtho. Thesis. Played on doctor's advice or as part of self-initiated physical improvement or beautification program. Aim. Exercise. Work up a sweat. Relax the mind. Motive. Health, vitality, desire for prolongation of youth. Obstacles. External. Finding someone of like motive to play with. Internal. Doubts that tennis is really helping. The temptation to be drawn into Perfecto or Goodo. Subgame B. Funno. Thesis. Played neither for winning nor to become good, but for fun alone. A game rarely played in its pure form. Aim. To have as much fun as possible. Motive. The enjoyment in expression of excellence. Obstacles. External, none. Internal. Being pulled into self-won games. Subgame C. Learno. Thesis. Played out of self-2's desire to learn and grow. Aim, evolve. Motive, enjoyment of learning. Obstacles, external, none. Internal, tendency to be drawn into self-won games. These 3 subgames can all be played at once without interfering with each other. They are internally harmonious with self-2's innate desires. The competitive ethic and the rise of Goodo. Many serious tennis players in our society, regardless of the reasons which they may think motivated them to take up the sport in the first place, end up playing one or another version of Goodo. Many start tennis as a weekend sport, in the hope of getting exercise and a needed relief from the pressures of daily life, but they end by setting impossible standards of excellence for themselves, and often become more frustrated and tense on the court than off it. How can the quality of one's tennis assume such importance that it causes anxiety, anger, depression, and self-doubt? The answer seems to be deeply rooted in a basic pattern of our culture. We live in an achievement-oriented society, where people tend to be measured by their competence in various endeavors. Even before we received praise or blame for our first report card, we were loved or ignored for how well we performed our very first actions. From this pattern, one basic message came across loud, clear, and often. You are a good person and worthy of respect only if you do things successfully. Of course, the kind of things needed to be done well to deserve love varies from family to family, but the underlying equation between self-worth and performance has been nearly universal. Now, that's a pretty heavy equation, for it means that to some extent, every achievement-oriented action becomes a criterion for defining one's self-worth. If someone plays bad golf, it comes somehow to mean that he is not quite as worthy of respect, his own or others, as he would be if he played well. If he is the club champion, he is considered a winner, and thus a more valuable person in our society. It then follows that the intelligent, beautiful, and competent tend to regard themselves as better people. When love and respect depend on winning or doing well in a competitive society, it is inevitable, since every winner requires a loser, and every top performance many inferior ones, that there will be many people who feel a lack of love and respect. Of course, these people will try hard to win the respect they lack, and the winners will try equally hard not to lose the respect they have won. In this light, it is not difficult to see why playing well has come to mean so much to us. But who said that I am to be measured by how well I do things? In fact, who said that I should be measured at all? Who indeed? What is required to disengage oneself from this trap is a clear knowledge that the value of a human being cannot be measured by performance or by any other arbitrary measurement. Do we really think the value of a human being is measurable? It doesn't really make sense to measure ourselves in comparison with other immeasurable beings. In fact, we are what we are. We are not how well we happen to perform at a given moment. The grade on a report card may measure an ability in arithmetic, but it doesn't measure the person's value. Similarly, the score of a tennis match may be an indication of how well I performed or how hard I tried, but it does not define me, nor give me cause to consider myself as something more or less than I was before the match. My search for a game worth playing. At about the age I was tall enough to see over the net, my father started me on tennis. I played the game more or less casually with my cousins and older sister until I was 11, when I received my first tennis lesson from a new pro named John Gardner at Pebble Beach, California. That same year, I played in my first tournament in the under-11 division of the National Hardcourt Championships. The night before the match, I dreamed of the glory of being a dark horse winner. My first match was a nervous but easy victory. My second, against the second-seeded player, ended in a 6-3, 6-4 defeat and with me sobbing bitterly. I had no idea why winning meant so much to me. The next few summers, I played tennis every day. I would wake myself at 7 a.m., make and eat my own breakfast in 5 minutes, then run miles to the Pebble Beach courts. I usually arrived a good hour before anyone else and would spend the time hitting forehands and backhands tirelessly against a backboard. During the day, I would play 10 or 15 sets, drill and take lessons, not stopping until there was no longer enough light to see the ball. Why? I really didn't know. If someone had asked, I would have said that it was because I liked tennis. Though this was partially true, it was primarily because I was deeply involved in the game of perfecto. There was something I seemed to want badly to prove to myself. Winning was important to me in tournaments, but playing well was important day by day. I wanted to get better and better. My style was to think I would never win, and then to try to surprise myself and others. I was hard to beat, but I had an equally difficult time winning close matches. Though I hated losing, I didn't really enjoy beating someone else. I found it slightly embarrassing. I was a tirelessly hard worker and never stopped trying to improve my strokes. By the time I was 15, I had won the National Hardcourt Championship in the boys' division and felt the rush of excitement at winning a major tournament. Earlier the same summer, I went to the national championships at Kalamazoo and lost in the quarterfinals to the seventh-seeded player, 3-6, 6-love, 10-8. In the last set, I had been ahead 5-3, 40-15 on my serve. I was nervous but optimistic. In the first match point, I double-faulted in an attempt to serve an ace on my second serve. In the second, I missed the easiest put-away volley possible in front of a packed grandstand. For many years thereafter, I replayed that match point in countless dreams, and it is as vivid in my memory now as it was on that day 20 years ago. Why? What difference did it really make? It didn't occur to me to ask. By the time I entered college, I had given up the idea of proving my worth through the vehicle of championship tennis and was happy to settle for being a good amateur. I put most of my energy into intellectual endeavors, sometimes grade grubbing, sometimes a sincere search for truth. From my sophomore year onward, I played varsity tennis and found that on days when I did poorly in my academic work, I would usually perform badly also on the tennis court. I would try hard to prove on the court what I had difficulty proving scholastically, but would usually find that lack of confidence in the one area tended to infect the other. Fortunately, the reverse was also true. During 4 years of collegiate play, I was almost always nervous when I walked onto a court to play a match. By the time I was a senior and had been elected captain of the team, I was of the intellectual opinion that competition really didn't prove anything, but I was still tight before most matches. After graduation, I gave up competitive tennis for 10 years and embarked on a career in education. While teaching English at Exeter Academy in New Hampshire, I realized that even the smartest of kids interfered significantly with their ability to learn and perform academically. Then, while a training officer on the USS Topeka, I saw how impoverished was our system of education and how backward our methods of training. When I got out of the Navy, I joined a group of idealists to found a liberal arts college in northern Michigan. During its short 5 years of existence, I became more and more interested in learning how to learn and how to help others learn. I studied the work of Abraham Maslow and Carl Rogers in the late 60s and studied learning theory at Claremont Graduate School, but did not really make a practical breakthrough in learning until while on sabbatical from education, I taught tennis during the summer of 1970. I became interested in learning theory and, that summer, began to gain some insights into the learning process. Deciding to continue teaching tennis, I developed what came to be called the inner game, a way of learning that seemed to increase tremendously the learning rate of students. It also had a beneficial effect on my game. Learning a little about the art of concentration helped my game revive quickly, and soon I was consistently playing better than ever. After I became the club pro at the Meadowbrook Club in Seaside, California, I found that even though I didn't have much time to work on my strokes, by applying the principles I was teaching, I could maintain a game which was seldom defeated by anyone in the local area. One day, after playing particularly well against a very good player, I began wondering how I might fare in tournament competition. I felt confident of my game. Still, I hadn't played against ranked players. So I entered a tournament at the Berkeley Tennis Club in which top-ranking players were competing. On the appointed weekend, I drove to Berkeley with confidence, but by the time I arrived, I had started to question my own ability. Everyone there seemed to be 6'5" and to be carrying 5 or 6 rackets. I recognized many of the players from tennis magazines, but none of them seemed to recognize me. The atmosphere was very different from that of Meadowbrook, my little pond where I was chief frog. Suddenly, I found my previous optimism turning to pessimism. I was doubting my game. Why? Had anything happened to it from the time I left my club 3 hours before? My first match was against a player who literally was 6'5". Even though he carried only 3 rackets, as we each walked to a backcourt, my knees felt a bit wobbly and my wrist didn't seem as strong as usual. I tested it several times, tightening my hand on the handle of my racket. I wondered what would happen out on the court. But when we began to warm up, I soon saw that my opponent wasn't nearly as good as I had imagined. Had I been giving him a lesson, I knew exactly what I would tell him, and I quickly categorized him as a better-than-average club player and felt better. However, an hour later, with the score 4-1 in his favor in the second set, and having lost the first set 6-3, I began to realize that I was about to be beaten by a better-than-average club player. All during the match, I had been on edge, missing easy shots and playing inconsistently. It seemed my concentration was off just enough so that I missed lines by inches and hit the top of the net with every other volley. As it worked out, my opponent, on the verge of a clear victory, faltered. I don't know what was happening inside his head, but he couldn't finish me off. He lost the second set 7-5, and the next 6-1. But as I walked off the court, I had no sense that I had won the match, rather, that he had lost it. I began thinking immediately of my next match against a player highly ranked in Northern California. I knew that he was a more experienced tournament player than I and probably more skilled. I certainly didn't want to play the way I had during the first round. It would be a rout. But my knees were still shaky. My mind didn't seem able to focus clearly, and I was nervous. Finally, I sat down in seclusion to see if I could come to grips with myself. I began by asking myself, what's the worst that can happen? The answer was easy. I could lose 6-love, 6-love. Well, what if you did? What then? Well, I'd be out of the tournament and go back to Meadowbrook. People would ask me how I did, and I would say that I lost in the second round to so-and-so. They'd say sympathetically, oh, he's pretty tough. What was the score? Then I would have to confess, love and love. What would happen next? I asked myself. Well, word would quickly get around that I had been trounced up at Berkeley, but soon I'd start playing well again, and before long, life would be back to normal. I had tried to be as honest as I could about the worst possible results. They weren't good, but neither were they unbearable. Certainly not bad enough to get upset about. Then I asked myself, what's the best that could happen? Again, the answer was clear. I could win 6-love, 6-love. Then what? I'd have to play another match and then another until I was beaten, which in a tournament like this was soon inevitable. Then I would return to my own club, report how I did, receive a few pats on the back, and soon all would again return to normal. Staying in the tournament another round or two didn't seem overwhelmingly attractive, so I asked myself a final question. Then, what do you really want? The answer was quite unexpected. What I really wanted, I realized, was to overcome the nervousness that was preventing me from playing my best and enjoying myself. I wanted to overcome the inner obstacle that had plagued me for so much of my life. I wanted to win the inner game. Having come to this realization, knowing what I really wanted, I walked toward my match with a new sense of enthusiasm. In the first game, I double-faulted 3 times and lost my serve. But from then on, I felt a new certainty. It was as if a huge pressure had been relieved, and I was out there playing with all the energies at my command. As it worked out, I was never able to break my opponent's spinning left-handed serve, but I didn't lose my own serve again until the last game in the second set. I had lost 6-4, 6-4, but I walked off the courts feeling that I had won. I had lost the external game, but had won the game I had wanted to. My own game, and I felt very happy. Indeed, when a friend came up to me after the match and asked how I'd done, I was tempted to say, I won. For the first time, I recognized the existence of the inner game and its importance to me. I didn't know what the rules of the game were, nor exactly what its aim was, but I did sense that it involved something more than winning a trophy. Chapter 9. The Meaning of Competition. In contemporary Western culture, there is a great deal of controversy about competition. One segment values it highly, believing that it is responsible for Western progress and prosperity. Another segment says that competition is bad, that it pits one person against another and is therefore divisive, that it leads to enmity between people, and therefore to a lack of cooperation and eventual ineffectualness. Those who value competition believe in sports such as football, baseball, tennis, and golf. Those who see competition as a form of legalized hostility tend to favor such non-competitive forms of recreation as surfing, frisbee, or jogging. If they do play tennis or golf, they insist on doing it non-competitively. Their maxim is that cooperation is better than competition. Those who argue against the value of competition have plenty of ammunition. As pointed out in the last chapter, there is a wealth of evidence showing how frenzied people tend to become in competitive situations. It is true that competition for many is merely an arena for venting aggression. It is taken as a proving ground for establishing who is the stronger, tougher, or smarter. Each imagines that by beating the other, he has in some way established his superiority over him, not just in a game, but as a person. What is seldom recognized is that the need to prove yourself is based on insecurity and self-doubt. Only to the extent that one is unsure about who and what he is, does he need to prove himself to himself or to others. It is when competition is thus used as a means of creating a self-image relative to others that the worst in a person tends to come out. Then the ordinary fears and frustrations become greatly exaggerated. If I am secretly afraid that playing badly or losing the match may be taken to mean that I am less of a man, naturally, I'm going to be more upset with myself for missing shots. And of course, this very uptightness will make it more difficult for me to perform at my highest levels. There would be no problem with competition if one's self-image were not at stake. I have taught many children and teenagers who were caught up in the belief that their self-worth depended on how well they performed at tennis and other skills. For them, playing well and winning are often life and death issues. They are constantly measuring themselves in comparison with their friends by using their skill at tennis as one of the measuring rods. It is as if some believe that only by being the best, only by being a winner, will they be eligible for the love and respect they seek. Many parents foster this belief in their children. Yet in the process of learning to measure our value according to our abilities and achievements, the true and measureless value of each individual is ignored. Children who have been taught to measure themselves in this way often become adults driven by a compulsion to succeed which overshadows all else. The tragedy of this belief is not that they will fail to find the success they seek, but that they will not discover the love or even the self-respect they were led to believe will come with it. Furthermore, in their single-minded pursuit of measurable success, the development of many other human potentialities is sadly neglected. Some never find the time or inclination to appreciate the beauties of nature, to express their deepest feelings and thoughts to a loved one, or to wonder about the ultimate purpose of their existence. But whereas some seem to get trapped in the compulsion to succeed, others take a rebellious stance. Pointing to the blatant cruelties and limitations involved in a cultural pattern which tends to value only the winner and ignore even the positive qualities of the mediocre, they vehemently criticize competition. Among the most vocal are youth who have suffered under competitive pressures imposed on them by parents or society. Teaching these young people, I often observe in them a desire to fail. They seem to seek failure by making no effort to win or achieve success. They go on strike, as it were. By not trying, they always have an alibi. I may have lost, but it doesn't count because I really didn't try. What is not usually admitted is the belief that if they had really tried and lost, then yes, that would count. Such a loss would be a measure of their worth. Clearly, this belief is the same as that of the competitor trying to prove himself. Both are self-won ego trips. Both are based on the mistaken assumption that one's sense of self-respect rides on how well he performs in relation to others. Both show fear of not measuring up. Only as this fundamental and often nagging fear begins to dissolve can we discover a new meaning in competition. My own attitude toward competition went through quite an evolution before I arrived at my present point of view. As described in the last chapter, I was raised to believe in competition, and both playing well and winning meant a great deal to me. But as I began exploring Self-2's learning process in both the teaching and playing of tennis, I became non-competitive. Instead of trying to win, I decided to attempt only to play beautifully and excellently. In other words, I began to play a rather pure form of perfecto. My theory was that I would be unconcerned with how well I was doing in relation to my opponent, and absorbed solely in achieving excellence for its own sake. Very beautiful, I would waltz around the court being very fluid, accurate, and wise. But something was missing. I didn't experience a desire to win, and as a result,